Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined this week by Ken Katkin, who is now, or at least for this semester, a professor of law at University of Colorado. Ken, how is it in Colorado?
Colorado is fantastic. It's sunny and beautiful out every day. There's virtually no mosquitoes here. The mountains are beautiful, and I love being out here.
Oh, I love mountains too. And as a matter of fact, I have a soft spot in my soul for not having mosquitoes, having been a recent Florida transplant.
Yeah.
So I understand that. Well, Ken, it's always wonderful to have you. And I think one of the first things that we want to take a look at this week, and this has been a big revelation, and this might actually take a bit of time, is the Woodward book that has come out, and then the Trump response to that. So really, I think there's kind of two stories going on here. One is the book itself and what it may or may not reveal about the Trump presidency. And I think the second thing that's happening here has been the response to the book, which has kind of brought us back to the question, fake news, and what does that mean in reporting? And so I think we might want to start with that first question, which is, you know, the book itself and what it's kind of doing. And I know that you have actually owned the book. I have only gotten to read excerpts of the book to this point. Yeah. But we've got some really fascinating quotes already coming out, right? So we've got Kelly calling Trump, quote, an idiot. We got Cohn calling him a professional liar. We got Mattis saying he's got the fifth or the sixth grader understanding of any issue. We've got everybody calling his bedroom the devil's workshop. And so, I mean, we have some, he's sitting there and he's tweeting these things out early in the morning. And the appearance here is a staff that is trying, you have a White House that is trying to basically hold the line against an incompetent buffoon. I think that seems to be, at least in the points that I've read, the overall take on this. So you've read a little bit more about it. What do you think about the book itself and what it might suggest about the presidency? And then we'll kind of take that second question in a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, you know, all the things that you said, that's sort of the big the big takeaway. But I a lot of that stuff had been previously reported anyhow. I mean, I think the thing that the Woodward book does is it gives more credibility to those kind of reports, because in the past you'd have, I think several of the quotes you just said had been previously reported in newspapers before the Woodward book came out, but the White House and the people alleged to have said them would always deny them. And so you ended up having people looking at that, I think, through a largely partisan lens, where people who didn't like Trump credited those kind of reports, and people who liked Trump, you know, thought of all that as fake news. And I think because of Woodward's reputation and his experience and the reporting techniques that he uses, which in a way are controversial, because he usually doesn't attribute in the books who's giving him most of the quotes. But what he does do is he says that he's corroborated them all with multiple sources. And so he's really putting his own credibility on the line there. Do you believe that he's corroborated all this from multiple sources? But I think because of the track record that he's established, people do tend to believe that. So I think the significance of it mainly is with those independent voters who weren't sure, you know, if they believed those kind of reports before. I think more of them are coming to believe them now.
Well, and I think another interesting part about this is that you can think of Trump as not being a great president, but I think that this kind of paints a picture of a man who, I mean, you're making some pretty bold claims when you're talking about trying to kind of like pull things off the president's desk, when you're talking Yep. about him being a fifth grader. So, you know, once you kind of get beyond that question of, you know, how much credence do we give to him, these are pretty, I mean, I'm a presidential scholar, and for me, these seem like really really big claims. You know, you don't have these kinds of claims about previous presidents, even in some cases, from your worst enemies. And in this case, theoretically, this is coming from inside the White House itself. What do you mean? Do you think this paints a different kind of picture for the unique nature of the Trump presidency?
Well, I guess there were claims like that about Woodrow Wilson as well, right? That he had basically lost his mental capacity in the final year or two of his presidency.
Was a result of a disease. Yes. Yeah. His wife had kind of taken over.
Yeah. So that was slightly precedented. But the other thing, though, I mean, I think the thing about taking papers off his desk, you know, I hate to run to Trump's defense here, but I feel like that might not be as unusual as it was made to sound by Woodward or in the portrayals, because I think what you usually have in prior White Houses is more of a functioning policy flow system, so that say the chief of staff is actually having a lot more control over what gets onto the president's desk in the first place, and so here. You know, there's sort of a chaotic policy flow, and there's a lot of people who have access to putting things on Trump's desk, and they can make end runs around the chief of staff. And so at least the idea there that then, you know, the chief of staff or someone who's authorized by the chief of staff would go in and steal stuff off his desk. It sounds very dramatic, but it may be functionally equivalent to just having never let the thing get onto his desk to begin with, which is a little bit more of a feature of many administrations, I think.
Now, I definitely agree with you on that point. What I think is kind of interesting, though, is what you were kind of calling that the chaotic management style. You know, again, taking a look at the turnover rate that we have in the White House. And I think that at least the pieces that I have read seem to indicate that there is a consistency of chaos.
Yeah. And certainly he has this kind of style where, you know, on any given day, people are it's like you've got all these courtiers sort of praying for his favor. And whoever's in his favor that day could sort of walk in and put anything on his desk. And it doesn't, I think that's very unusual, because I think that usually everything's properly vetted before it gets to the president's desk. And lots of people have had to sign off on things before they get to the president's desk.
I was going to say, just at a minimum, at least there is an established procedure by which there's a group of people where that happens, right? And I think that changes president to president. But this kind of shifting nature of it all the time, I agree with you, I think is highly unusual.
Yeah. So, I mean, the things that we're reading are dramatically being stolen off of his desk are, I think, equivalent to, like, in any other administration, those things would never have been able to get to his desk. So it's, the other thing, though, maybe... you know, maybe one sort of partisan difference you and I might have, although maybe you won't, I don't know, is it seems to me that what characterized by these by the White House of senior staff as sort of you know, keeping him from doing crazy things, I certainly do think there's an element of that, but I think a different element of this from my perspective is that he in the primaries actually ran as a candidate who wasn't a conservative, wasn't yoked to the traditional conservative movement. And I think that helped him get elected. That certainly helped him in the general election, where he got a fair amount of Democratic crossover votes, particularly in the Midwest, that people saw kind of policy differences between Trump and, say, someone like a Ted Cruz or something like that. But I think that a lot of the people that wound up in working in his staff, his senior staff, or in his administration, are sort of movement conservatives who are there, you know, kind of cynically taking advantage of him. You know, just the fact that he was elected and that he doesn't know what he's doing to advance the very conservative agenda that they would have liked to advance, but one of their, you know, one of their candidates didn't win the primary. You know, and so that has an undemocratic feel to me. It's not, I don't really look at these heroes that are rescuing the country from Trump's erraticism. I also look at it as like, well, they found we've got this guy Bozo the Clown who can get elected, and we don't have anyone who openly espouses our agenda who can get elected. So we'll just you know, support him and then just try to ramp through our agenda.
You know, I don't entirely disagree with you there, Ken. As a matter of fact, one of the things that probably marks me a little bit different than many of my fellow kind of conservative libertarians is the fact that I've been deeply, deeply disappointed in the number of individuals who were willing to work with the Trump administration, right? I think in an ideal world, after Trump wins the election, you say, look, there was a problem. We need to come back from this. You know, he's won the Republican nomination, but that doesn't make him a Republican. That doesn't make him conservative, and it certainly doesn't make him a libertarian. And that you simply distance yourself from it. You allow him to do what he's going to do. Allow that to fail if you believe that's going to fail, which I think many of us did. And if it, where it succeeds, let it succeed. And then to come back and try to win in that wake, as opposed to, I think, working with a more than flawed presidency. And so on that front, I agree, but I guess I even maybe agree in a different way that I was disappointed with the individuals who worked with him in the first place. And that'll actually come later when we talk about Cruz too. But a second kind of question that is here about the book has been the response to the book, which I think has also been fascinating. I don't know how much you've kept up with this, Ken. You know, obviously the president's Twitter account has been a buzz about this. He is called, quote, Bob is a liar, a dim operative prior to the midterms. His book is a, quote, a scam. I don't talk the way I'm quoted. If I did, I would not have been elected president. These quotes were made up, and Woodward's book is a joke. So he's had a bunch of hits. And then, fascinatingly tied around this, we have seen a number of what you would call the alternative right sites kind of popping up back up in the lexicon, like Proud Patriots, where they've been manipulating quotes from Woodward to say that he's admitting to lying in the book. And this has been flying around and retreated briefly by the president. What do you think this says about this ongoing question? You were kind of alluding to it earlier, a fake news. I mean, is this just another book where those who support Trump are going to say, yeah, it's all made up because it's fake? Or do you think this has a different kind of chance because it comes from a different kind of source of maybe making a midterm or a sway impact on elections?
Yeah, I think it'll have an impact on the election, but I think that the partisans on both sides won't be very affected by it. I think partisan Democrats, probably including me, were already thinking all this stuff even before the Woodward book said it. And I think partisan Republicans still aren't going to believe the Woodward book. But I do think there is, the elections, this is a closely divided electorate. Elections are going to be decided by people who are neither partisan Democrats nor partisan Republicans. And I think that this will definitely have an impact because the stature and credibility of the source, Bob Woodward. I think it is making people who never really knew what to believe a little bit more inclined to believe this kind of reporting.
Well, you know, on this note, the other big item that came out last weekend that we haven't been able to deal with on the show yet was the anonymous New York Times op-ed. And I know that we've both been really interested in this one. It's a fascinating op-ed. And I highly recommend, my guess is if you're a listener of the Politics Guys, you've probably already listened to it, read it. But if you haven't, I really do highly recommend that you take a look at it because it's fascinating on a number of levels. And I think the overarching take from the piece, I've got some quotes here we might talk about a little bit more, but the overarching take from the piece is basically, listen, don't worry that the president is having anti-democratic leanings. We've got you, American public, and we're going to make sure only the good stuff happens. So what do you think, not just about that mindset, Ken, but also about, I mean, publishing it with the New York Times is a fascinating step. So he or she thinks this is a big enough deal that they need to say, look, it might be obvious that things are anti-democratic, but we're here. We're propping it up. We're making it work. And don't worry, the best things are still happening. What do you think about the op-ed in general and that kind of takeaway from the op-ed?
Yeah, well, I do not blame the Times for publishing it because I do think it's newsworthy that somebody, if they know that it's a real top administration official who had these things to say, I think it's newsworthy. I probably would have published it if I was at the New York Times too. But nonetheless, I have an incredibly, negative view of the author. I think it's a terrible thing that the author did. I think that the idea that the author is basically saying, you know, trying to say to the conservative movement, you know, don't worry, even though Trump was not elected on the conservative platform, we're still advancing the conservative agenda undemocratically, I think is terrible. And then also the idea that the author is trying to say to maybe centrists or Democrats, you know, everything's fine, really, you know, and so, you know, you can not be alarmed. Well, I mean, these people whoever this author is, they haven't actually worked against what I would see as the very worst excesses of the Trump administration, things like the family separations or the travel ban or the support for neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups or the demonization of the press as the enemy of the people. You know, you're talking about, you know, some administration official who says, yeah, I'm fine with all that stuff. But when it comes to free trade, even though Trump openly ran on a platform against free trade, I'm working in his administration. I'm going to work to undermine that. And so you should be reassured. It seems to me to lack political morality in all respects, both in terms of judgment about what are the important things to be working against, and really that it's fundamentally anti-democratic and dishonest, I think.
Well, the other thing that is fascinating to me, and the more times I've read the piece, the more it kind of strikes out at me, is the author says, quote, they want the administration to succeed, end quote. But then they go on to worry, quote, to preserve our democratic institutions, that they have to stop, quote, his misguided impulses and the, quote, president's amorality and, quote, his anti-democraticness.
Yeah.
And for me, what I want to say, and this goes back to what I was mentioning in a minute ago, if you honestly believe that the president of the United States is being anti-democratic and that he is attempting to bring down the democratic institutions, why in heaven's name are you still working in his White House?
I don't. Of course. Yeah.
I mean, this would be like basically, I mean, this might sound extreme, but I think at some point you get to this point to say, well, look, I need to be in Hitler's inner circle because that way I can save him from his worst impulses from the German people.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, that obviously that's a loaded analogy, but it's not a completely unfair analogy. And somebody like this could actually do more more good if they really believed what they're saying, if they quit the job, came out publicly, went on all the news shows in their own name and said all this stuff.
Exactly.
And also the idea that they want the administration to succeed, I find that to be very disingenuous because what they really mean is they want their agenda to succeed, no matter whether or not that's actually Trump's agenda. And so Trump ran as Republican, and you've got, you know, some more traditional Republicans in this administration. And what they're really saying is we're going to make sure we advance our agenda. And to the extent that that varies with what Trump's stated agenda was, we're going to frustrate his ability to implement his stated agenda and make sure we stick with the more traditional Republican agenda. And you know, who voted for them? You know, I don't see where they get any stature or legitimacy to do that.
Well, and, you know, the other thing that, as I've read it and reread it, that also fascinates me is this line where the author says, this isn't the work of the so-called deep state. It's the work of the steady state. And I think the only reason you can include this in here is because you are obviously trying to poke at the president of the United States,
right?
Because you know that he thinks this. So you're, I mean, by saying this, you aren't alleviating the president's fears. You are, for some reason, poking at those fears. And that is fascinating. I mean, you could just have taken that line out, right? What,
yeah.
The only purpose I can see in that is that you're trying to basically say to the president, it really is the deep state. See, here I am. And I don't, that, it's a, I don't know. It's just a fascinating that they have those kinds of lines in there. And I don't know if that struck you as well, Ken, or if you have thoughts about that or what.
Yeah. It's a great point, Trey, because it's inconsistent with the stated theme of the op-ed, right? The sort of stated theme of the op-ed is, you know, we're quietly making sure he doesn't do anything terrible. But then by sort of putting that line in there, it will very much, you know, take away any ability of whoever wrote it do anything quietly like that, right? Because now Trump is kind of provoked, and he's you know, being told, well, you've got your own political appointees who are actually working to undermine you, and so, you know, you've got to, you know, he's going to want to be twice as vigilant about that now. And so whatever benefit there may have been, and I mean, I'm doubting whether there was any benefit, but whatever benefit the author is claiming there was by that author working to undermine some of the president's worst excesses, that one sentence that you just quoted now makes it impossible for the author to continue to do that.
Exactly. And, you know, this is just a kind of a throwaway. I don't think I have much to say about it. But did you notice that the author uses the tagline for Reason magazine when he sums up conservatism, which I found fascinating, given that Reason is the anti, it's, I mean, that's the libertarian magazine in the country.
Yeah, it's like what, free markets,
free minds and free markets. And I thought, when has the conservatives ever been about free minds? But anyway, be that as it may, I mean, I'm a libertarian. I know, but my bias is coming out here.
And the examples that are given, it's all free trade examples. But I find that very telling, because the one, you know, I've said it already, but the one thing that Trump openly ran on, where he was extremely opposed to traditional Republican and conservative ideas, was his trade agenda. So if that's the thing that the author wants to undermine, and I think, you know, that line you've quoted again really is very ideological and shows that that's the author's primary agenda there, as do most of the examples in the op-ed, then I think that can only be seen as utterly anti-democratic, at least as anti-democratic as anything that the author is really accusing President Trump of.
Yeah, it's a fascinating take, and when you take it together with the book, it just... It paints an unfortunate picture, regardless of your political positions.
Yes,
So, kind of moving away from the president, which I think, you know, we've probably spent enough time on that for now, and the books and the New York op-ed, we want to move now to Ted Cruz's surprisingly, I would say for some, surprisingly, I'm not as shocked about this, the tight race that Ted Cruz is having in Texas. As a matter of fact, as of this morning, the Real Clear Politics average was plus 3.2 in favor of Cruz. Two of the three most recent polls have him positive outside the margin of error, and one still have him in the margin of error. And I don't think this is where Cruz himself was hoping to be. Cruz, obviously, and I mean, not quite shockingly, argues, quote, with the election of Donald Trump, the far left has lost their minds. The extreme left, they are energized, they're angry, and they have a lot of hatred for President Trump. And so I think that, you know, Cruz is obviously, and for important political reasons, attempting to pin this on the left. I'm not actually as shocked about this, and I'm curious what you think about this take, Ken. I think that what Cruz is actually fearing getting a backlash over is the way that he handled the election with Donald Trump. I think had he just either stayed anti-Donald Trump or had gone all in with 2 feet with Donald Trump, that he would be in a much better position than he is today. I think that that whole business with being wishy-washy has hurt him with his base and hurt him with his turnout. I think he would have been much better off. As a matter of fact, in my opinion, I think he would be a much more electable candidate right now had he simply stuck with his president, then candidate Trump is not fit for office, and he never had that whole fiasco with the so-called quote-unquote endorsement speech that he pulls out of effectively at the end. What do you think about all that, Ken?
Yeah, I think you could be right, although there's a lot of moving parts here, right? So I think the true Trump supporters are, you know, they didn't like that about Cruz, that he sometimes was against Trump, sometimes for Trump. But on the other hand, I don't know that they have anywhere to go. The true Trump supporters are not going to vote for O'Rourke, I don't think, right? So,
but they might stay home.
They might stay home, right? So that's a piece of it. I think another piece of it is the immigration politics of the Trump administration. It's a big issue in Texas. It's polarizing on both sides. And I think you have, the Latino voters are generally voting in most elections in lower numbers than other communities. And so I do think, to the extent that that vote is energized a little bit by Trump's immigration policies, that's going to inherently close the gap. Texas is still a Republican state, but if more Latinos would vote, then that's going to push it towards being a more Democratic state. And I feel like that may be happening now. So it's hard for me to tease out, you know, how much this represents demographic trends and issues versus how much it represents the individual candidates. And Cruz was never a very likable guy, and I think some of the other Republican senators were recently quoted as saying that, right? That we need more likable candidates, maybe, or something like that. And I think that's an issue too. But yeah, I think he did mishandle what his attitude towards Trump was going to be during the 2016 campaign. He did seem to flip flop a lot on that in a way that left nobody very happy. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know that causes Republican voters to, if they're partisan Republicans, I think they want the Republicans to keep the Senate no matter what. So I'm not sure I have the image in my head of who's the voter. Who's the Republican voter who actually stays home because of this, I guess?
Yeah, and you bring up two interesting questions, one of which I've looked at a little bit, because you talk about rightfully that you have the increasing Latino population. But when you take a look at the studies currently on Latino turnout rates, they are actually going down a little bit. And as a matter of fact, in places like Florida, for example, which again, I'm a little even more familiar with because of having lived there, there was a question about how is that going to affect local races? And the answer was it really hasn't yet impacted them because the increase in the Latino population is offset by the minor decrease in turnout in elections among that group. So I'm not sure if that population shift is yet enough to explain the Cruz shift. Now, that may be very bad news for Republicans, right? Because if I'm right in that assertion, that means there's a bunch of potentially untapped voters, and if more of them show up, then you have more easy potential wins in what used to be safer states and safer seats. On the second part of that, where you're talking about, who's going to stay home, well, I actually can see there being a number of Republicans now staying home because one of the things that you need is energized voters who are actually going to be willing to show up at the poll. And I think one of the areas where Republicans generally outweigh Democrats is on that. I mean, you don't have to have worked on many campaigns to know about every Republican prays for rain on election day.
right.
And so I think what you might be seeing here is enough apathy towards Cruz. It's not that they don't want a Republican to win, but apathy towards Cruz, especially when you live in a state where you think, they're going to win anyway, whatever. I think that apathy is part of what's hurting him significantly and bringing that overall number down. Now, how much of the variability is that particular question? I think that's up for debate. But no, I think you're right. I mean, in the long term, that question about Latino voters is a fascinating one. But I don't think it's yet changing those voting patterns just because of the decrease in turnout that we're seeing among that population.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. And, I think, Cruz, although he obviously thought he'd have a much bigger margin now than he does, I mean, he's still ahead. It's likely that he's going to get reelected. Texas, I mean, a lot of people have said Texas will be a blue state in 20 years or something. So the question just based on demographics. So in any individual election, the question is probably going to come down to whether there's unusual turnout from one side or the other in that election.
Yeah, and where you are at that demographic change. And I think that's one of the things, that it's difficult when you're studying elections and you're looking at electoral outcomes is just like any slow-moving sets of trends, no singular election is generally the tipping point, right? It's this slow accumulation of elections where you see these patterns change over time. And so when you say, hey, I see this change coming, and you're right, changes don't mean next elections. That variability increase changes, maybe a percentage point. But, as you get to this where you're talking about, Cruz, I mean, I'm sure that he thought he'd be further ahead than three. It doesn't take too many more movements to start having a different kind of election. But anyway, on a bigger scale, another big issue has been the NAFTA issue. So what has happened so far, listeners? We've talked about this a little bit before, but there's been some more recent developments. And that is that the United States and Mexico have reached a preliminary bilateral deal to continue NAFTA, which again has been in place since 1994, like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, after being signed by President Clinton. But Canada is still out there, and they need to have an agreement by the end of the month, because that's going to mark the point of time where once you go through all the other notification processes, that it needs to be done in time, right? So we've talked about that. We won't continue to talk about that. What it appears to be right now, the big tipping points, Ken, and I'm curious what you think about this, is the United States wants access to Canada's dairy market. Canada has a pretty managed system. It's actually called a supply management system. And that basically means, listeners, that government has strict regulations on how much dairy products can be produced, and then they place really high tariffs and quotas on those items being shipped into the country. Now, nobody had originally been upset about this, but originally the United States could ship in, without those tariffs and quotas, ultra-filtered milk, which is basically stuff to make other dairy products. So you don't eat this stuff, but you use it to make other things. That got changed in 2016, and this appears to be the United States and specifically President Donald Trump's biggest beef. And then on the Canadian side, they don't want any changes to Chapter 19 of NAFTA, which is the way that dispute resolutions are handled. And so far right now, it does not look like, at least from my opinion, I've watched a lot of treaties play out, it doesn't look like this is going to make the deadline. So what do you think about kind of these last hangups? Are there other issues? And do you think that they make the deadline or not? And if they don't, is this effectively the end of NAFTA? What do you think, Ken?
I'm almost hesitant to say what I think, because I feel like all the reporting I've been reading is missing some very big points here in terms of the legal context for all this, right? NAFTA is a statute. It's a statute that's been enacted by Congress. It can only be changed by Congress. And so, you know, in sort of focusing on all these day-to-day machinations of negotiations, or Trump's announcements, you know, I feel like some people might be losing the forest for the trees. And you know, most of the media that's been covering it, I think I'd say that about, because NAFTA's not going to change. It's not going to go away. Trump can negotiate whatever he wants. He can announce whatever he wants. But there's under the NAFTA statute, there's a 90-day congressional review process if he wants a change, and they don't have to accept his change. When we're talking about 90 days now, we're talking about, this means the next Congress, not the current Congress. I think it's very likely that the Democrats will have the House, and they have no particular reason to go along with Trump on any of this stuff. And even if they don't, changing a statute like NAFTA should be filibusterable in the Senate. So whether the Democrats have the majority or are still in the minority, they're certainly going to have a minority large enough to filibuster. So, you know, without bipartisan agreement in the U.S. Congress, none of these changes are going to happen. And if we're talking about excluding Canada or trying to force something on Canada that they won't agree to, I don't see bipartisan agreement to do that really happening.
Now, that's an interesting point, and you're absolutely right. But don't you think that there are enough Democrats in Congress, specifically the Senate, who would like to see NAFTA taken apart anyway, that they might be willing to get on board with this, not because they particularly care about Donald Trump's deal, but about a chance to change some international trade policy that they've seen as a failure since 1994?
Yeah, I mean, that I think is, I think you really put your finger on why Trump is doing this, because I think he thinks it'll be a wedge issue for Democrats, that it's going to be divisive within the Democrats. But I think he, as he sometimes does, you know, he's overplayed his hand here, because, you know, even though, you know, the Bernie Sanders or Sherrod Brown wing of the Democratic Party, Elizabeth Warren, you know, people like that have been very critical of trade and might like to see relaxation of current free trade arrangements, make trade a little bit more encumbered. I think even those senators, what they don't want to do is insult our best allies like Canada, right? And so the way that Trump has done this, really sort of just picking a fight with Justin Trudeau, just, you know, just because that might play to some parts of his base in a very, you know, doing it in a very insulting and disrespectful way. I don't think that the Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanderses and Sherrod Browns are going to go along with that. I think they'd much rather send a message to Trump that he should engage in ordinary diplomacy and not in just kind of picking fights with our friends who are our weaker friends. I think the political context for this becomes more important than the actual trade deals because of the way that Trump has pursued all this.
You know, and that's an excellent point. And I and myself am conflicted about, you know, do they score the political points by not giving him this particular win, or do they take the policy points? And I don't know. It's a difficult one, especially when you're facing two more years of a presidency. And it would be, in some ways, a potential win to say, hey, you know, we flipped this script on Trump, and now we've blown up NAFTA the way we've always wanted to. But you're right. That has its own consequences, especially given the way that this has, the way that the White House has engaged in this renegotiation or this new negotiation, however you want to think about that.
Yeah, okay, I can add one more thing too. I think
yes,
Pelosi already said basically what I just said. So I saw it reported in the New York Times just yesterday that Nancy Pelosi warned the Trump administration that NAFTA should be maintained as a trilateral pact between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Now, I know, you know, there are certainly Democratic members of Congress further to the left than Nancy Pelosi, but I think Pelosi's relatively far to the left, and if she's saying that, I think you can basically take it that's where most Democrats are going to be.
Now, the one thing that I would note a little bit different is that Nancy Pelosi is a House member, and I think that the views between the House and the Senate, even within the similar parties, can be different. So I think you're right about the House. But as it stands right now, Republicans don't need the House. The question, I think, is about the Senate.
No, they need that. They actually need the House because NAFTA is not a treaty. It's a statute.
Really?
But yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's not a treaty. It's a U.S. statute that's been enacted by Congress.
But that would only come into effect, of course, if Democrats take the House, is what I'm suggesting, though.
Yeah, I think Democrats will definitely take the House.
Right, yeah. So you either, yes, okay. I think we're on the same page on that. I was.
yeah.
The difference was where we think, yeah, I think that's going to be a little bit closer. As a matter of fact, we have purposely, the listeners have been, and they're dying to get us talking about our, you know, who's going to win or lose, but we have been kind of holding off until we get a little bit closer to actual election season. It was one of the things we've been talking about in a couple of shows ago. But I know we have just enough time for one more issue, and I think that one more issue is undoubtedly Manafort and his plea deal. And Ken, I know that you have a really unique and I think a really insightful speculative take on this. So why don't you share that with us?
Yeah, so we were talking about this earlier, Trey, and I guess I think that I take it with, of course the news has reported correctly that Manafort has signed a cooperation deal as part of his plea agreement, and that the cooperation deal commits him to very complete cooperation with the special counsel's office, including that he's supposed to have to answer any question they want, have to show up at any meeting they call him for, isn't necessarily allowed to bring his lawyers to those meetings. And even, you know, I think there's a provision of it, although I can't imagine this would really happen, where he's even agreed to participate in undercover operations on their behalf. And so it looks pretty much like a complete cooperation agreement. But my thought is that even though that's what he signed and that's what he agreed to, we really don't know how sincere he is about carrying that out, because I think he would have incentives to make that agreement no matter whether or not he was making it in good faith. Right? It may be that he made it in good faith, and I'm certainly not ruling that out. And it may be that he's planning to fully cooperate as he's agreed to. But I think there's some reason to suspect that's not a done deal. And that, you know, we do know that George Papadopoulos signed a similar agreement over a year ago already now, actually, and then did not honor it, right, that he did not cooperate at all. And when it came time for him to be sentenced on the minor charge that he pled guilty to, The special counsel's office went in front of the judge and said Papadopoulos did not cooperate, and we don't want to give him any benefit of the doubt, and we're asking you to throw the book at him. And that judge didn't throw the book at him. He gave him only 2 weeks. So Papadopoulos actually got away with signing a cooperation agreement and not honoring it, and probably came out better for having pursued that course than any other course he could have pursued. And I think that Manafort may see that. Now, I think a judge would be a little more likely to throw the book at Manafort than at Papadopoulos. And Manafort's already been convicted on enough counts that I think, you know, depending on how the sentencing guidelines are applied, he's probably facing 7 or 8 years in prison already, just based on the counts that he's already been convicted of. So, but in his situation, I think what he benefits, the reason he would benefit by agreeing to cooperate, even if he's not planning to cooperate, is first of all, it saves him the financial expense of defending another trial, right? It would cost him, you know, at least $100,000 or more just to pay lawyers and defend the trial. Second of all, it prevents public disclosure of a lot of facts, which would happen if a trial is actually starting in the next couple weeks. Then right now, before the election, you know, that trial would be taking place. Things would be coming out that would presumably be harmful to President Trump, and so that would not be in Trump's interest. And so I think by not having the trial, Manafort saves himself money, he saves Trump embarrassment, and if he never cooperates, and the end game is that a year from now, the special counsel comes in front of the judge and says Manafort never cooperated, and you should throw the book at him. I think that actually creates a signal to Trump that maybe he'll give a pardon to Manafort, because he, you know, he doesn't like flippers. He likes the loyalists who stick by him, and that may be more beneficial to Manafort than anything else, because that could even get him out of serving the sentence that on the charges that he's already been convicted of. So that's sort of how I'm thinking about his incentives here. I think, you know, there's no certainties, but I think the paths that he pursue by trying to pretend he's going to cooperate for about a year and then just never really doing it, I think that the end games to that path are at least as desirable for him as the end games for any other path.
No, and I think that was a really interesting take. It's not one that I had personally thought about, but it's certainly plausible, and I think that's a fascinating one. Well, listeners, I think we have actually wrapped up the show. And Ken, thank you again for joining me. If you want to hear more from Ken and me, I've got good news for you. You can. If you're a supporter of the Politics Guys, you get the supporters exclusive show, which we're going to be filming in just a couple of minutes. This week, we're going to be taking a look at Puerto Rico. We're going to be taking a look at the books we've been reading. And trust me, you want to know about some of the books that Ken's got his hands on, because even I couldn't get my hands on them. So I'm interested in that myself. So that's it. Thanks. I hope that you guys liked what you've heard. Listeners, you can head to politicsguys.com/support. Or head to politicsguys.com and click on the support link and subscribe. And that will get you access to the supporters exclusive show. And we just want to thank you in advance if you are a supporter, because that's what makes this possible. And we really love doing this for you. So please, if you can't support, we ask if you would subscribe to our show on iTunes. Sharing those episodes with your friends and family on social media are really big for us, and rate us on iTunes. Nothing helps us more than putting us higher in those ranks, and if you can ask your friends and family to do the same thing for us, that would be amazing. As always, you can get a hold of us at mail@politicsguys.com or on our social media sites at facebook.com/politicsguyspage. That's facebook.com/politicsguyspage, or on Twitter @politicsguys. And then as one final note, we are asking about a change in the format of the show. So when you're reaching out to us, if you would please let us know what you would think if we did a slightly longer Saturday show where we also addressed your questions to the Politics Guys. In other words, what if we took that Ask the Politics Guys Wednesday show and put it on the weekend with this show? It would make the show a little bit longer, but it might get to more of the things that you're interested in. So when you reach out to us at mail@politicsguys.com or Facebook Politics Guys page or @politicsguys on Twitter, respond to that. Would you like that longer show, or do you like it broken up into two? We want to do what you, the listeners, like the most. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. This episode was produced by Trey Orndorff. We'll have a new show on Wednesday. We hope you'll join us then.